Welcome to the Cohort Sisters podcast, where we bring to life the stories, struggles, and successes of Black women navigating doctoral degree programs and their lives beyond the degree. I'm your host and the founder of Cohort Sisters, Dr. Ijeoma Kola. Cohort Sisters is an online global network empowering Black women pursuing doctoral degrees by providing resources, mentorship, and community. For more information, please visit our website at cohortsisters.com. Welcome back to the Cohort Sisters podcast. Today, I have the pleasure of speaking with Dr. Morgan Gerald, an assistant professor of psychology at McAllister College, whose work examines how the media influences young Black women's beliefs about gender and sexuality. A Georgia native, Dr. Gerald received her PhD in psychology at the University of Michigan after getting her bachelor's degree at the illustrious Spelman College. In this episode, Dr. Gerald and I discuss how she has balanced showing up for her community, her students, as well as herself in the past year in the wake of police brutality and community unrest in Minneapolis. We also chat about how the publish or perish mindset can impact your self-esteem in graduate school, the difficulty of going on the job market as an interdisciplinary scholar, and the major differences between attending and teaching at a small liberal arts college versus a large R1 university. Let's get into our conversation. Thank you so much, Dr. Morgan Gerald, for joining us in the Cohort Sisters podcast. I am excited to chat with you today. It's actually the second time that we had scheduled to chat because, you know, you're based in Minnesota. Lots of things have been happening in Minnesota lately. And so actually the first question that I want to know kind of before we jump into your biography and your background and your education is, as an assistant professor, you know, how do you balance real life things? You know, how do you balance showing up for your students, showing up for, you know, your departmental responsibilities in the midst of an uprising, a very well justified kind of community uprising?
Thanks so much for having me. I'm super excited to like finally be able to do this. Yeah, it's been quite a year. So I'm in my third year. And like, I mean, every year that I've been here, something super eventful has happened, either in my professional or personal life. But this past year has been like quite a doozy for sure. So last summer, after George Floyd's death and then the uprising, during that same time, I was working on my third year review material. So I think either the week that most of the protests started, like nationwide and worldwide, my file was due, actually. And I had been under so much stress already just from like pandemic teaching, getting ready for teaching in the fall. Others in my cohort that were also turning in their file materials were kind of like, what can we do? Like my white members of my cohort. And they ended up asking for an extension on our file materials, which I really appreciated. I thought was like a really good act of allyship from them. I also think my institution probably should have like just gone ahead and offered that, because they were offering many other things, like offering to put faculty up in hotels if their kind of livelihood had been disrupted by the National Guard, but somehow didn't seem to think about that. So I think the way that I've most dealt with it is by like asking for what I need, you know, to the extent that I have like the capacity to do that. Like that extension last summer really helped. And just like realizing that I wasn't going to be able to get done everything that I planned. And then towards the end of this year, I mean, the Derek Chauvin trial going on at the same time as other acts of state violence were happening, and then Dante Wright's murder is just so close to home. Yeah, I just ended up pushing things back, canceling classes, like doing kind of what we needed to do to get through. And I think one thing this year has shown, just put into perspective for me, like what things are really important, you know? And so I think if we have to miss some classes or cut back some course material to like maintain everyone's well-being, then that was definitely helpful for me and like worth it for everyone, I think.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. I really just jumped in. I didn't even get a background of like who you are, where you're from. I just like, I want to know. It has been burning on my heart, you know, for the past couple of weeks. Like, how is it over there? Okay, so let's back all the way up. Tell us a little bit about yourself. Where did you grow up? Where are you from? And what is something that you'd like to do to keep yourself sane and healthy in this era that we're living in?
Okay, so I grew up in Atlanta, Georgia. I specifically in Stone Mountain, which is kind of on the east side. And I was born and raised there. I went to college in Atlanta as well. I went to Spelman College. So I'm very much a Southern girl in the Midwest. And now I've been in the Midwest for now, I think like 9 years, maybe. I also went to grad school in the Midwest. So I've grown to like a lot of parts of it, including like the doing out things outside culture. I didn't grow up doing as much like hiking and that kind of thing. But now that I've lived here, that's one of the things that I've really enjoyed, especially this past year, just getting outside. And the before times, I also really like traveling, and hopefully that will be something that I can do again. And just like, you know, spending time with my family and friends. I'm also a really big soccer fan. I really like international soccer, but also the US women's team.
When you say international soccer, because I come from a soccer family, are you like a Premier League person?
Yeah, I'm a fan of Arsenal.
Even you're an Arsenal fan?
They constantly disappoint, yeah.
Yikes. My younger brother is a Chelsea fan, and so he's the only one who's super passionate about it in our house, but I guess we're like by default a Chelsea household, so I'm supposed to not like you, I guess.
That's fine.
Yeah. That's awesome. So you are a Southern girl in the Midwest, and you kind of hinted at the fact that you did your master's degree and your doctoral studies at Michigan. So can you talk about how you ended up in a doctoral program? When you were at Spelman, did you know that you wanted to pursue a PhD? Were you one of those people who, when you were five, you knew? Kind of how did you come to the decision to get a doctoral degree?
Yeah, no, I definitely was not one of those people. Okay, so when I was at Spelman, I had already gone into college knowing that I wanted to major in psychology. I took a psychology course in high school and I really enjoyed it. Like, I really just like to think about individual differences and identity. But I wasn't ever really sure what I might do with the major. So like going into the summer after my sophomore year, I was like, man, I really need to do something related to my major this summer. Because the summer before I interned with a politician, and I knew that really kind of wasn't going to be my jam. And I Googled that school year, like, what does psychology majors do? And it turned out that many of them do research. And I Googled a bunch of summer research programs. And that summer, I ended up going to the University of Michigan to do a summer research program. And so I worked with Dr. Robert Sellers, who I always say kind of provided me with like a really life-changing opportunity that summer. It was the first time I'd ever done research, and I just loved it. I just like fell in love with the process. I was really interested in the topic. And I obviously also very much enjoyed Ann Arbor that summer, though I do think the summer is kind of a lie. So I went back to Spelman, and then I got involved in another professor's lab there. So I kept doing research during the year. And then the next summer, I did another summer research program at Berkeley. And that kind of like solidified that, you know, across all these different institutions and in different labs, I really liked doing research. So I ended up then applying to grad school in my senior year.
Yeah. Why did you know that the PhD route was the right choice for you as opposed to getting a master's in psychology?
I had not taught, but I thought like I had an inkling that I would want to and kind of continue on in academia in that way. And so I think that was kind of my primary motivation. I'll also say that in psychology, my understanding is that it's a little less common to get a master's if you're not wanting to go into practice in some way. So if you're not wanting to like become a counseling psychologist or be involved in like a therapy context, I kind of knew I was mostly about the research and teaching, and that the PhD seemed like the best path to kind of accomplish those goals.
Yeah, makes sense. And so I'm assuming since you went from college straight into a PhD program, what were some of the things that you did during your senior year or junior year when you decided, hey, I'm going to follow this path, aside from doing summer research programs and getting experience in a lab? What were some of the other ways that you made your application really competitive? Because we do have a lot of, you know, people who are in college and they're really sure that they want to pursue a doctoral program, but they are not really sure how to kind of make their application stand out. So do you have any advice on that?
Yeah. And I'll say one thing I wanted to say before was when I think back to how I found out about grad school and got interested in it, I wish that I'd had a professor reach out earlier and say, like, this is something you might think about. Like, I wish I wouldn't have had to like, Google, what should I do? And I think too often we catch students too late in their undergraduate careers. So like in their junior or senior year, when they haven't necessarily gotten the research experience that they need. And so it's one reason that I try to get students through a little earlier and also really encourage them to get involved in research or to do summer research programs. What you should do in undergrad depends on where you're at. So for me specifically, I had done like quite a bit of research by the time I got to the fall of my senior year. Some other things that I undertook, though, were in my summer research programs, beyond the various benefits that you get working in a specific lab, they also provided me with GRE classes both summers. So that was really great. I always recommend that students take the GRE like the summer before they start their senior year, because there's so much going on in the senior year. Though I don't know. I mean, a lot of programs are dropping the GRE requirement now, so maybe less of an issue, but I think it's hard to prioritize something like a GRE when other things are going on. I also did a honors thesis my senior year that may have helped. It certainly like just helped me learn more about like some potential interests I might've had for grad school. So I recommend that. But otherwise, I think that letters of recommendation are really one of the most important parts of the application. And that's, again, not something you can necessarily get kind of like last minute. It's like something you want to think ahead about and like trying to maintain and sustain certain relationships. I was set up super nicely because I had done research in two labs that weren't my institution over the summer, and then in one lab for 2 years at Spelman. And so I kind of naturally had three people to write me letters that were really familiar with my research. But I also would recommend just like thinking through what courses you've taken, maybe like your research methods course, for example, if that professor would be willing to write you a really great letter of recommendation. Those kinds of things would be good to think about.
That's all really good advice, especially the part about starting early. It's funny because, you know, one of the current requirements of being a member in cohort sisters is that we try to not admit people who are like freshmen and sophomores, because I think in my mind, you just like don't know what you're doing with your life yet. And so like there's no need to be overwhelmed with all of the information that's available. But I think that you bring up a really good point, because if you're just, you know, arriving by senior year and saying, hey, I want to get a PhD, you are kind of already a couple of years late in terms of if you want to apply that cycle, you do need a few years to get some research experience. So you've definitely given me a little bit of food for thought in terms of how we kind of structure the cohort sisters membership. Awesome. So I'd love to kind of talk about now your transition into a doctoral program. You had done research experience at Ann Arbor. It sounds like the summertime in Michigan pulled you there. Did you consider other schools, other programs, or how did you decide that that was the best place for you?
When I was applying, I felt sure, like 100% sure that if I got into Michigan, I was going to go for Michigan because my experience was so positive. I ended up applying to fewer programs, I think, than like maybe the average number. I applied to 7 programs, and I now consider myself to be a social psychologist, but I applied to a range of programs within psychology. So I applied to clinical programs, developmental programs, and social programs. And in the end, it came down to Michigan and one other school. And it was really close, actually. So I got 4 interviews out of the 7. And then I think ended up getting admitted to 3. And it's really nice. Yeah, like once you start going and visiting the campuses, it gives you a different idea of like things that you're looking for, what to expect. In the end, I decided on Michigan, though, for a few reasons. So first, I really wanted to be at a school where I felt like I could be successful as a Black woman. And for me, the best way to tell that was that there were other Black women alum that have been successful, you know. And so Michigan has a really large psychology department. They also have the highest number of Black faculty in a psychology department in the United States, other than Howard. And because there are so many Black faculty, there are also a lot of Black graduate students. And, you know, like grad school brings with it its ups and downs. But I would say for the most part, when I was there that summer and then when I visited before grad school, you know, I got the picture that the grad students were happy, that they were being supported, that it was like a good place for them to thrive. And so that was really important to me. And I think that was also true of my experience. My research is also really interdisciplinary in a way. So my interests are in psychology, but also intersect with like gender and women's studies, with media and communication studies. And I really like that Michigan was a place that supported that kind of interdisciplinarity, that encouraged students to work with multiple advisors. And I think that in the end, I worked with two main advisors in grad school, and they both helped me grow and learn in different ways and really support me. And so that was really important as well.
How did you determine that Michigan was a place that welcomed interdisciplinary scholarship? Like, how did you kind of suss that out?
In the recruitment weekend, they are big on letting you know that your funding isn't tied to your advisor as it is in some other psych programs. So your funding comes from the department, and so you can work with whoever you like. Of course, you list people that you're interested in working with on your application, but I could see when I visited that lots of students were part of multiple labs, and that just seemed to be something that was like very much encouraged. My specific program that I was in also is like rooted in interdisciplinarity, and they were pretty forthcoming about that. And so that was another sell, just like learning more about the program requirements. And after that, it just seemed like a really good fit for me.
Awesome. So as you talked about the fact that your specific program at Michigan not only had a lot of Black students who were seemingly happy, but a lot of Black faculty as well. Where this question is coming from is because I feel like if I had so many Black faculty, like I wouldn't know who to choose from to advise me. So how did you go about finding the right advisors when you were spoiled for choice?
Yeah, that's a really great question. Even though there were a lot of, quote, a lot of Black faculty, there are so few at other schools. So then when you say a lot, it might not be as far ranging as you might think, but there were two in particular. So I'm really interested in gender and sexuality and intersectionality. And Liz Cole, I came in and she was my primary advisor, and she's really well known in the field as the person that kind of brought intersectionality to psychology. And so she was pretty much a no-brainer. Like, we recognized really early on that we had lots of intersections in our research. She was at the time also doing a lot of research on body image, and I was also doing a lot of research on body image. I do less of that now, but my honors thesis was on body image, and I had read a lot of her work. So that was kind of the first way that I identified that. And we also spoke over email and during the interview weekend. And then I also worked with Monique Ward, who's a developmental psychologist, and she does research on like gender and sexuality in the media. And my honors thesis in college had also focused a little bit on the media, and the lab I worked in college also focused on sexuality in the media. So a lot of like intersecting interests. I also just kind of got really lucky that Liz and Monique were working on developing a project together a few months before I started grad school. And when I came in, I ended up working on that project, and it ended up kind of providing data for my dissertation. So they were already kind of collaborating, and so it seemed like a really natural fit. So kind of for me, just like a lot of the pieces of the puzzle ended up fitting together really well.
Yeah, that's awesome. You talked about funding earlier. Did you have full funding? How much funding did Michigan give you? And were all students funded?
Yeah, things might be different now. I'm not sure. When I applied, all students were guaranteed 5 years of funding. We did have the funding, which was really great. And it was pretty great considering the cost of living in Ann Arbor. I think it was, pretty okay for a grad student. But in my first year, I applied and then got the NSF GRFP. And so that really helped me out a lot. So if I hadn't gotten the NSF, I think I would have had to teach for at least 5 semesters as a part of my funding package. And I obviously really like teaching. Like, I'm at a teaching college now, but I think in grad school, it's really helpful to have as much kind of time and space to focus on your research as possible. So with the NSF, I was only required to teach 2 semesters. And so I did that and really enjoyed it, but it also gave me lots of other time to work on my dissertation stuff and help support me. I think that grad school is a really different experience when you're not stressed about your finances, and not like I was like bawling on the NSF, but I was doing okay. And so that also helped me a lot. It also allowed me to stay a 6th year. I ended up deciding to stay a 6th year in grad school. And so it gave me the funding to do that.
Two things. I love how you said bawling. I felt when I had my NSF, I did feel like I was bawling because no one was checking for me. I did not have any responsibilities. Like it was just like my money to do whatever I wanted to do it. So I feel you on it. It was low-key bawling. It sounds like most people in your program were finishing in 5 years. What influenced your decision to stay for a sixth year?
I think that Michigan wanted us to finish in 5. It seemed as I was approaching the end that it was becoming way more common for people to stay a sixth year. And they didn't love that because they really didn't have like the funding for that. Personally, I stayed a sixth year just because I needed more time on my dissertation. I was like a little slow to get publications out. Not slow for me, but it wasn't until the beginning of my fifth year that I started to have more papers out. And when they started coming out, then they really did, but it took a while. And I just wanted more time to kind of build up my CV and be competitive for the job market. But also kind of just like personally, my dad was sick a lot through my program and that slowed me down in some areas during some years. And so it just allowed me to have more time to finish up without feeling so much pressure. And I really appreciated that.
Yeah, totally understandable. I always find it so interesting when people who graduate from programs that typically finish in either 4 or 5 years, this language of like, I spent an extra 6 years, like there are people in history who were there for like 8, 9, 10 years chugging away. So it's always so funny to me when people are like, oh my gosh, it took me so long. I took 6 years. I'm like, okay. But you know, different disciplines have different average times to degrees. So I get it, but it still always like makes me laugh because I think in the humanities, historians, anthro people, like we just be in there forever.
That's what I hear.
Yeah, it's true. It's true. Can you actually talk a little bit about your dissertation? What did you end up writing about?
My research kind of has two lines. One part of my research is interested in what the media communicate about race and gender and sexuality and relationships to Black adolescents and Black young adults specifically, but also kind of thinking about media use more generally amongst a mainstream American population. And one particular thing that I'm interested in is how gendered racial stereotypes are communicated in the media. So how do people learn about gendered racial stereotypes, specifically of Black women? And so my dissertation focused on those stereotypes and specifically thinking about, well, what does it mean for Black women when they're aware that other people might be holding these negative stereotypes for their group? And the dissertation looked at the Jezebel stereotype specifically, which portrays Black women in terms of being hypersexual and promiscuous and kind of sexually insatiable. So I want to know when Black women are aware that other people might see them as Jezebels, might see them as really hypersexual and promiscuous, how might that influence their own kind of sexual attitudes and behaviors? So I did 3 studies for my dissertation, but the kind of general hypothesis for all 3 studies was that being aware that people hold negative stereotypes about one's sexuality might lead Black women to kind of be drawn more to respectability politics, to display more conservative sexual attitudes and behaviors. And so I kind of focus on the ways that these negative stereotypes or awareness of the stereotypes might inhibit Black women's like sexual expression and sexual freedom.
That's really interesting. And was your hypothesis proven right by your studies?
Yeah, for the most part. Yeah.
Nice. That's really interesting.
I did an experimental study where I didn't find as much support for my hypotheses, but it's been, you know, it's no worries. I've been kind of building on those and redoing them since grad school. So yeah, for the most part, yes, those hypotheses are supported. Yeah.
Interesting. So now you are currently still doing that work in your research. Let's talk now about before we kind of talk about what you're doing now, I actually want to talk about the transition from graduate student to assistant professor. So you said you only taught for 2 semesters because your NSF got you out of teaching. When you're finishing up your degree, how did you position yourself for the academic job market? And how did you kind of decide that you wanted to be at a institution that's more focused on teaching than research?
My job market experience wasn't super calculated. I think some people go in with more definite goals or aims, but I was kind of really spooked by the job market, to be honest. So, you know, everyone was like, just apply to as many jobs as you can. anything that seems like it will be relevant, just apply. So I didn't, to be honest, go in thinking like, I want to be at a liberal arts college. McAllister had an opening and it seemed like it might be a really good fit. So yeah, I ended up applying to like 70 jobs, I think. I don't know if that's a lot for psychology. That might be just like the average or something. I'm not really sure. And so I mentioned before that my PhD program was kind of interdisciplinary. It also made it difficult to position myself on the job market. And I am like a lover of interdisciplinarity, but it does make it hard to kind of frame your materials. I didn't come from like a traditional social psychology program. And I never really identified in that way, I think, until I started going on the job market when I had to market myself in that way. But kind of just like PhD programs, I applied to lots of different jobs. And I think the best recommendation I would have is to tailor your materials specifically to the different kinds of jobs. So I applied to jobs in communication studies and gender and women's studies and psychology and different areas of psychology. And I had different sets of job materials for all those different jobs. And even though I applied really widely, I didn't apply anywhere where I thought I absolutely like would never want to work here or would never want to live here. So I don't recommend that. I think that's kind of a waste of everyone's time. And so that allowed me to be pretty specific in my applications about why I did want to work specifically at different places. So I would say for me that year, the job market went really smoothly. Like I have no idea what the post-pandemic market is going to look like, but I came for an interview at McAllister and I really enjoyed it. I kind of got good vibes from my now colleagues and the students seemed really bright and were asking really great questions. And I liked like the idea. I came, you know, from a kind of smaller college. So I liked the idea of having smaller classes. And getting to know my students better than I had when I was at a big R1, but also still being at a liberal arts college that really valued and would support my research. And so it just seemed like a good fit for me.
The schools that you've been at have been different in a couple of ways. So how was the transition from an HBCU to a PWI and then a smaller college to a really big school and then back to a smaller school? You kind of touched on the last question a little bit. Was there anything that stood out about the HBCU to PWI transition? Or do you feel like you were prepared for that?
Well, I mean, even though I grew up in Atlanta, I had gone to predominantly white private schools for most of my life. So going to Spelman might have been more of a transition, I guess, in some ways. I don't know. I mean, it did suck, I'll be honest. Like, I just had such a great, rich experience at Spelman, and then having to go from that to Michigan was challenging in some ways. I think I just miss the community. I think grad school is just a really isolating experience no matter where you are. And you have to be way more intentional about seeking out and building community. And, you know, I didn't have to put as much effort forth in college. At Michigan, though, I think I had an easier transition just because there were a number of Black graduate students. So for example, at Michigan, there is a Black Psychology Association. So like just an organization just for the Black grad students in psychology. And there's also one for the Asian grad, psych grad students and the Latinx psych grad students. And so, and I know a lot of schools, maybe there's just one per department for everyone, or just maybe one for like the whole university, you know? But I would say on average, we would have about, you know, like 40 Black grad students in our program per year, which is like quite a bit. And so that was super nice. I always felt like I had a really good like support system there. I'll also say that there's like a pretty strong pipeline of Spelman and Morehouse students that go to Michigan. Like they've definitely done a lot of work to establish that pipeline. So for example, my roommate, my first year was also graduated from Spelman with me in psychology. There were a lot of my classmates that ended up in the psych department at Michigan. So it wasn't as bad as it could have been. And I feel really fortunate. Going from a small school to a big school, one front that I was maybe less prepared on was just like the seminar style nature of grad classes. At least at Spelman in the psych department, we have fewer of those. I had taken some gender studies classes at Spelman where that was like more of the format, but I was like not as prepared for that. I don't know that it was like related to size though. I think, you know, that's one thing that's super nice about graduate school is that the cohorts are fairly small, your classes are fairly small. And then even when I was teaching, we taught discussion sections of 25 students each. So the classes were still pretty small. You know, when you're at a larger school, there are lots of opportunities and resources, lots of places to find money and that kind of thing, which can feel overwhelming at times, but I really enjoyed it. Like I liked eventually learning more about the different resources that were available to me. And so that was great. And then going from a big school now to a smaller school. Yeah, I'll say again that I just really like knowing my students super well. You know, like they're graduating this week and one thing that we do is write them personalized notes and give them a gift for graduation. And I just finished writing mine yesterday. And, you know, it's like, I love that I know enough about students to be able to write them a note for graduation. And, you know, that's not something I would be able to do at a larger school. At a liberal arts college, your job is like really student-centered, and that can bring with it some additional work or labor, especially if you're a faculty of color. But for the most part, I really enjoyed it.
Nice. Yeah, thanks so much for answering that multi-layered question. So the name of your lab now, even though you are at a teaching institution, you are able to conduct some research. And the name of your lab, I love, I thought so clever. It's called the I Am Lab, which stands for Intersectionality and Marginalization Lab. How did you come up with that wonderful name? And also, if y'all are listening, you got to go to the website because the graph, like the logo is just on point. The branding is top notch. I just really love it. So yeah, how did you come up with that name for your lab?
I wanted a clever acronym because I feel like that's all the, you know, that's what everyone's doing in psychology right now. But I wanted it to be really meaningful as well. And I wanted it to include intersectionality because that encompasses so much of what I do. And I also wanted it to be general enough that it would also describe any like future lines of research that I might want to do. So I didn't want it to be like so specific to what I was doing right now. Two summers ago, I was at a friend's bachelor's party, and she kind of had like a hiking yoga retreat for a week for her bachelorette, which was really awesome. And she was a friend from grad school, from my lab in grad school. And so a bunch of the people she invited on that retreat were also psychology professors, most of us either like in our first or second year. And just like we were hanging out in this cabin that we'd rented one day, and we were all like, let's come up with lab names for everyone. And like that afternoon, like literally everyone came away with like a bomb lab name and a bomb idea for a logo for the lab name. And I think, like, I think we just collectively came up with like 7 or 8 lab names. And I already had the idea kind of for mine, but that group helped me kind of refine it a little bit. So yeah, it was just awesome.
That's so nerdy and so cute. Meanwhile, other people on their like bachelorette parties are like, don't have any recollection of what happened. And y'all are out here creating lab names. I love it. Okay. What would you say was the most challenging part of your doctoral degree process? And then what was your biggest success?
I always say, you know, grad school like really humbles you. Anytime I ever thought that I was like on top of things, I would just get served like a nice slice of humble pie and just be brought back down. You know, I guess I'd say the hardest thing for me, which I mentioned a little bit earlier, is that it took a while for me to publish. And so much, unfortunately, of my self-worth was just so tied to getting publications out, you know, and I wish it hadn't. You know, I still think that's something that I try to really be aware of and protect myself against, trying not to feel discouraged by that. Because once it happened, like I always tell more junior people or grad students currently that like once it happened, it was like a waterfall. Like it just like really happened. But I just kind of, a friend was tweeting about this yesterday, how he was in his last year of grad school. He hadn't had publications for such a long time. And just this last week, he had at 3 come out. But I think until then, you can just feel like really low morale around that. Yeah, I just had a lot of like personal things going on. Like I mentioned that my dad was sick during grad school and my grandmother also passed during grad school. Making sure that I was supporting myself and engaging in self-care when that wasn't necessarily like explicitly valued or talked about by like my advisors, you know, I think all of that was just hard to balance, but ultimately I'm glad I kind of had to engage in that work for myself.
What are you the most proud of?
I ended up doing a lot of things that at one point in my life, I never thought I would be able to do. Both of my advisors were Black women. My dissertation committee was all women of color. And I kind of attribute a lot of what I was able to accomplish to being surrounded by mentors that could like see more in myself than I necessarily was able to at the time. So I think just like meeting all the milestones were like incredible achievements for me. Like when I passed my prelims, I just remember feeling like such a sense of accomplishment and achievement. Like, you know, like I really belong here, or like getting the NSF. Like, you know, I hate that it's like dependent on all these external kind of motivations and drives, but it was just like a nice sense of validation that, you know, I could do it. Certainly, I would say defending my dissertation was really great. My mom and my brother were there. I had like made a recording for my dad who wasn't able to be physically there. And I was just glad to see things culminate in that way, to have ended with a job that I was excited to go to, and to see that, like, yeah, I was able to do all these things that I may have doubted myself on, but that it ultimately worked out.
It did. And here you are a few years later into your role as an assistant professor. I didn't ask you this before. Is this a tenure track position?
It is. Yes.
Awesome. So you're about halfway through, give or take. So best of luck as you continue. We'll definitely be checking out your progress. What is one piece of advice that you have for current or prospective Black female doctoral students?
Is not to engage in social comparison. So, you know, I think that quote that comparison is the thief of joy is a really great one. And it's hard. I don't even feel like my program was super competitive, but there's just a way in which like the structures of grad school and academia encourage you to compare yourself with your peers. And it's just like not helpful for anyone. Everyone's like running their own race. Everyone's doing their own thing. Even if you don't know exactly what you want to do, I think you just have to kind of constantly be working to define what it is that you want to accomplish and where you want to be, and only be comparing yourself to that, you know, because that's really the only metric that's meaningful. Relatedly, the other thing I'll say is that I feel like a lot of people, including me, kind of come into grad school and just like want to know all the things and like want to show that they're like so smart, you know, in class and everything. I would have really benefited in the beginning had I been more able to be vulnerable and admit when I didn't know something. So I guess my piece of advice is that you don't have to know everything when you start grad school. And like, if you did know everything, then you wouldn't need to be there. And so I think it's just, you know, don't get too overwhelmed. I'm still learning things. I hope to be learning things for the rest of my life. And so I think going in with that attitude will just like help you be much more focused on your progress rather than like the end goal.
Yeah, that's an excellent, excellent piece of advice. So thank you so much, Dr. Gerald, for spending time with us today on the Cohort Sisters podcast. We will have links in the show notes to where you can find Dr. Gerald online. And yeah, we really appreciate your time. And thank you again.
Thank you so much for having me. This was really awesome.
Thank you again for listening to this week's episode of the Cohort Sisters podcast. If you are a Black woman interested in joining the Cohort Sistas membership community, or you're looking for more information on how to support or partner with Cohort Sistas, please visit our website at www.cohortsistas.com. You can also find us on all social media platforms at Cohort Sistas. Don't forget to subscribe to the Cohort Sistas podcast and leave us a quick review wherever you're listening. Thank you so much for joining us this week, and we'll catch you in next week's episode.